one concert every night, it's a lot of work, and usually...
If you're 70 years old.
Just,
well...
It's practical. No, but also the younger ones do that.
Wow.
The whole, there was a controversy with Milli Vanilli.
Was, oh, it, I remember,
wasn't
that
it them? Yeah.
No, they lips. What, I don't know what they lip sync. They did something somewhere. I don't know.
They got caught in the 80s for lip syncing, and then more recently,
they
Jessica
didn't
Simpson.
Make the album, I think.
Maybe not.
No. Yeah, and then they were forced to sing in public or something.
Yes, the thing with me with them is that they were actually just lip syncing to somebody else's singing.
Oh yeah.
Not their own. That was
right.
Even
so they in the music industry apparently you can't make any money from MP3s or the audio. So you have to go touring. So this may be a new development. People have to tour so much they can't survive it, so they had to go simulation.
This is an effect of the digital MP3 world. It forced music to retrieve lip syncing.
Yes, and they have to entertain the people. They have to dance
right.
To
they have to yeah perform up to the standards of
all the concert.
They must do multimedia.
Yes.
Okay, I have an article here, which was written in the New Musical Express, which is the other Rolling Stone kind of magazine in England. There's the Melody Maker and the New Musical Express. And it's an article by Charles Shar Murray. He was a longtime fan of Zappa, a journalist who supported Frank, and I don't know if he might have eventually got fed up with Frank, I'm not sure. But he is a legendary Zappa journalist. So we were in Europe in September 72, and we went to a concert middle of September 1972, and that was the first time Zappa had come back after being thrown off the stage, and he had a big band with him. So it was a different kind of Zappa doing what's called the Grand Wazoo albums. So Charles Shar Murray is walking around with Frank. So let's see what he says, I guess in London. So, outside the departure lounge of Luton Airport, you know where Luton Airport is, Roxy? What city is that in?
No.
Okay. Outside the departure lounge of Luton Airport is the nifty black Rolls. A couple of official-looking gentlemen in peaked caps are standing around it. As you approach, you can see an arm stretched along the back window. The arm is wearing a woolly, carpet-like sleeve, and at the far end is, as one might logically expect, a hand. Later inspection will reveal that this hand is pale, long-fingered, and unusually hairy. It belongs to a contemporary American composer named Francis Vincent Zappa. Now, Frank was not named Francis Vincent Zappa. He was named Frank Vincent Zappa. But back in 72, people probably didn't know that. So Zappa, who achieved much fame and a certain notoriety as the proprietor of an infamous rocking teen combo known as the Mothers of Invention, Zappa painfully swings his... there's the pain, because he's got, you know, this injury. Zappa painfully swings his legs out of the Rolls. The legs are wearing lilac pants and matching socks and brown patent leather Oxfords. He clicks his leg brace into place and stands up, casting an eye around. Holding a pair of shiny aluminum crutches, he's looking pale and wasted, all cheekbones, eyes, and mustache. "Excuse me," he says to a nearby journalist, and throws the crutches as hard as he can onto the concrete pavement. His feelings thus relieved, he shakes hands and makes his way into the airport coffee shop. So he was pissed off, throws his crutches as hard as he can onto the concrete pavement. He says to a nearby journalist, maybe there's other journalists there, or Charles is talking about himself. Zappa is embarking on the European section of a tour with a 20-piece band called Grand Wazoo, which includes Dean Underwood and his wife Ruth, Jim Gordon and a bunch of wealthy but anonymous L.A. session men, all of whom could have earned double the money staying in L.A. and working sessions. All of them are there because they'd rather play with the Grand Wazoo. There will be more technical information later in this feature. Frank Zappa was never the most conventional of souls, and as he crabs through the airport, crabs through the airport. People turn and stare. Still severely handicapped by the injuries he sustained at the Rainbow, he walks something like Ratso in Midnight Cowboy. In a trice, he is ensconced at a table with me, his wife Gail, a fellow man of letters, and his bodyguard slash valet. At this table, he would consume a Dunhill, two Winstons, 1.5 cups of coffee, and 1 forkful of a strawberry cream cake. Various members of the Grand Wazoo crop up and are greeted. The whereabouts of the score sheets are ascertained, and some getting acquainted takes place. Zappa rates the airport coffee shop 1.72 out of a possible 10, later amended to 1.71 after he notices some cracked plaster. 1 out of 10. 1.7. Almost 2. The master of bizarre business, Herbie Cohen, who later Frank sued because he found out his manager was stealing money from him, the master of bizarre business, Herbie Cohen, is there to organize the proceedings and is most indignant about a stunt that took place the previous night at the Oval. So that's where I saw Frank at the Oval, so this may be the next day. Studious devotees of the pop scene will know that the man who heaved Frank into the orchestra pit at the Rainbow performed this scurrilous act because his lady was in love with Frank and he wished to take what he considered to be appropriate action. At the press conference, the lady in question appeared to present Frank with a bunch of flowers. The authenticity of said lady was rather dubious, and Mr. Cohen was annoyed about the whole tasteless stunt, which he claimed was engineered by the organizer's PR man, Peter Harrigan. I wonder why Frank didn't like that. The lady in question appeared to present Frank with a bunch of flowers. Frank inquired darkly if I was Nick Kent, and when I assured him that I was not, had never been, and had absolutely no intention of ever being Nick Kent, things went fairly smoothly. The Wazoo, he said, would probably lose money, but due to the particular nature of the endeavor, he regarded it as worthwhile. Gail was asked why the Zappa Brood bore the names of Moon Unit and Dweezil. The Weasel, get it. Weasel, W-E-A-S-E-L. I guess a pun on Dweezil, D-W-E-E-Z-L-E. So Gail says, well, she said tolerantly, but with the air of someone answering an unusually foolish question for the 100th time, well, I figure that in about 20 years, names will get a lot more imaginative. So it's like giving them a good start for the future. With Herbie and longtime Mother's roadie Dick Barber, the industrial vacuum cleaner from 200 Motels, riding shotgun over the whole deal, things move reasonably fast to the next location. The Berlin Hilton. Have you ever been there?
Hello.
The Berlin Hilton, no less. So he's in Germany here. That would be the Luton Airport. I knew you should know what the fucking airport should be called. It's your airport.
You are not pronouncing it right, because what the fuck is that?
L-U-T-O-N, Luton. But there are like 5 airports, I think.
No, there was Schönefeld, Tegel, and Tempelhof in Berlin. Three airports.
So maybe this
now is... there is Tegel and Schönefeld, and Tempelhof is closed.
Only one airport. Now.
Oh, two. They're still working. One is they're building one, but it's not ready. It's supposed to be ready like 2 years ago, and it's still not ready.
So Luton, that might have been the airport way back. And it got names changed, redesigned, and be before your time. Okay, so he's at the Berlin Hilton. Downstairs in the Golden West Bar, Frank Gale and assorted members of the group are eating and drinking. Zappa is in good spirits, doing a hilarious impersonation of an Italian cabaret singer and talking about his plans for a real-life Reuben and the Jets. They did put out an album, The Real Reuben the Jets. I have the album. He says, we met this guy called Reuben Guevara. Laughter. And he wanted me to produce him, so I suggested that he call it Reuben and the Jets. So he went out to get some old pachucos, but they couldn't play, so he got some new ones. Tony, and I guess he points out, slide guitarist Tony Durante, who's on the albums, is in the group. Next paragraph. Frank Schnitzel and Herbie's attempts to round everybody up for the sound check arrived virtually simultaneously, so the Wazoo piled into its bus to go to the Deutschland Hall. At this point, it may be appropriate to introduce some of the more interesting members of the Wazoo. Jerry Kessler is a small, middle-aged man with horn-rimmed glasses who bears a strong resemblance to Wally Cox. He spends most of his time being a lawyer and the rest playing cello. Earl Dumlin has worked with everybody from the Carpenters to Mantovani. Sal Marquez is a Texan trumpeter with a vast repertoire of handshakes. At one moment during the flight, he decided to demonstrate a handshake developed by him and Ainsley Dunbar, which takes rather a long time, what with its multitude of grips. Quoting Sal, "It brings people closer together, man," said Sal, while Frank rolled his eyes heavenwards and added in his most sardonic tones, quote, "like passing ships in the night," unquote. The town was festooned with posters depicting Frank in his famous yawning pose, in brackets, as photographed by Phil Franks on the front of the Chungus Revenge sleeve. Outside the hall, this yawning pose can also be him screaming. Outside the hall was a billboard advertising the next three concerts to be held there. Frank Zappa, Johnny Cash, and Disney on Parade. Inside the hall, all the equipment is set up on the stage, and the sound check begins. Zappa finishes writing F. Zappa on the 4 million pictures, posters, and album sleeves, and ambles onto the stage, where sound and lighting men are beginning to coordinate. Zappa and Tony Durante begin to jam, tight and funky, hot licks indeed, just a straight-ahead two-chord boogaloo. As different members of the band get mic'd up, they join in. Finally, all 20 are blasting away, Jim Gordon kicking the whole thing along till it screams like a supercharged Chicago. A wide-eyed German freak wanders up to me and asks, quote, "Was ist this song and is it on album? Was ist this song and is it on album?" I say, "Why, no, man. They're just jamming, is all." And he shimmers away. Zappa says, "Take the bottom end off the trombones," orders Zappa. "They're too murky. Kill the bottom on the trumpets. It sounds kind of weaselly." Assembly pool, that would be in London, and there are about 8,000 people in there.
Wow.
Plenty of streaked hair and makeup. The delightful fragrance of certain substances floating above people's heads, and everywhere you look, clusters of microphones. The children of Rubber Dubber are at work and fast. What is this? Don't know what Rubber Dubber is. The children of the Rubber Dubber are at work and fast, as Herbie Cohn and Dick Barber can take the microphone down. The bootleggers are putting them up again. Yes. A song or something called Time in a Word plays over the sound system. There are signs of life on stage behind the music stands and forests of saxophones. The band settles in and do a few little honks and bleats for tuning purposes. Then Larry the Dwarf comes on into a bright shower of applause, limps to the microphone and says, quote, "Good evening, boys and girls. The first piece we are going to play for you is entitled The New Brown Clouds." And then he translates it into German. "Die Neuer Brauner," he adds, and picks up his baton. So he's calling Frank, Larry the Dwarf. No, Dunbar isn't here, Frank says to somebody. What did he say about Dunbar? Ainsley Dunbar. Probably some audience member yells out, "Ainsley Dunbar there!" Who was a rock and roll guy before he played with Zappa in England. No, Dunbar isn't here, he says as an afterthought, and Wazoo is in full flight. So then Charles Charmery writes, "How to describe the Grand Wazoo? Over to Ian Underwood, renowned outwhipper, answering a bus driver who asked whether his band played pop music, country, and western, or what. Ian said, well, it's kind of like rock and roll, only it's been expanded and elaborated a lot. We have a basic rock and roll rhythm section of two guitars, bass, and piano, and there's a lot of guys playing brass instruments, and a guy on cello, and a guy on stage conducting it all. All the parts are written out except for the solos, where we get to do what we want. It's really good. You'd like it. So then Charles Shar Murphy says, it is, and I did. So it is good, and he did like it. Zappa has an astounding ear for the sounds available from every instrument, and he has assimilated these into the parts. The individual pieces are far less disjointed than one might expect, and many of them have clear and appealing melody lines. One piece that Wazoo performed in Berlin that wasn't in the program at the Oval, and then he says, see Nick, so this guy that Frank thought Charles was, Nick Kent, see Nick Funky Chicken Kent's exquisite piece elsewhere in this epoch-making issue. So I guess Nick reviewed the Oval concert. One piece that Wazoo performed in Berlin that wasn't in the program at the Oval was a piece entitled Approximate, because, as Zappa said, quote, it's approximately what was written down and approximately in tune. It's approximately what was written down and approximately in tune. Okay, rabid classifiers would have a hard time deciding whether Wazoo music was modern classical, advanced big band jazz, or gulp progressive rock. Gulp in brackets. But whatever it was, the audience enjoyed themselves hugely, especially the boogieing song called Think It Over. Well, especially the boogieing, quote, Think It Over, unquote. The three-movement, quote, Adventures of Gregory Peccary, unquote, and the old favorites, Penis Dimension, unquote. In brackets, an instrumental version of the number that got the mothers banned from the Albert Hall. So Penis Dimension was presented as an instrumental version. And Dog Breath. An amalgam of Dog Breath and the main title theme from Uncle Meat. The audience was vociferous in their approval, and they were rewarded with a slow blues encore and a thundering rhythm section version of Chunga's Revenge. I don't really think Zappa makes it as a blues guitarist, as he seems a little too facile and unemotional, but Chunga really, as we say in the trade, chugled. Back in the band bus, Frank was greeted by a round of applause from the musicians and announced he thought the whole thing had been, quote, pretty fucking good, unquote. Consider yourself introduced to Kenny Schroyer. He's a trombone player who's been working since the days of Stan Kenton, and he was Zappa's right-hand man on this project. Here with Schroyer on the Grand Wazoo, quote, I called around to see Frank, and he was sitting in his wheelchair playing all these lines on guitar, and he said, play this, and play that, and I did. Then he said he needed some more musicians, and I phoned around and got them. The thing was that most of them found it hard to memorize the charts, and so Frank, who has all the parts in his head, wrote it out in a week. What's the difference? Why would you write it out? They already tried to memorize the charts. What's the point of writing it out? Maybe the charts, you write out more instructions than what's in...
asking me?
Yeah. You don't know.
No, I suppose it was like for reference.
Well, they got the charts, and they can't memorize them. So why would he write it out? The charts is what you follow. Wait a minute. Maybe he's just saying the thing was that most of them found it hard to memorize the charts. And so Frank, who has all the parts in his head, well, it implies that that event comes after. He wrote it out in a week. But I was thinking, they're just saying that he wrote it out. It only took him a week to write all this stuff. So I'm not sure what the tense is. And, you know, there's a song called A Holiday in Berlin. And the article is titled Zappa, Holiday in Berlin, Full Blown. Let's see if Ian showed up yet. Nope. So, you want me to play something from Grand Wazoo?
Yeah.
Yeah, let's hear the music that we're reading about. What's this?
Oh, and Rubber Dubber Bob?
Yeah.
Was an underground label, rather. So they would go to the concerts and have these microphones up and record and then press sort of pirated records later.
Yeah, but how could Zappa's bodyguard later in the 80s would wander around the audience and, you know, beat anybody up who was recording? How come Frank let these people bootleg?
Yeah, maybe he wasn't aware of who they were at the time. Or
yeah, let's look at where is that sentence, rubber dubber. The children of the rubber dubber are at work and fast.
Yeah.
So maybe he's saying that
work at, maybe he's saying just general audience members are recording.
Oh,
like
no, here it is. No, here's what's happening. Herbie Cohen and Dick Barber are going around taking the microphones down. But the children of the rubber dubber are at work and fast. As Cohen and Barber take them down, the bootleggers are putting them up again. So it's a battle of of positioning the mics. It was not so uptight back then, because, you know, when John Smothers, the big black guy, became the bodyguard, he'd walk around and basically threaten people's lives if they were if they were bootlegging. Now, Frank was the most bootleg guy. And he got the FBI looking into it, and they couldn't figure it out. So Zappa took the bootlegs that had been distributed, you know, through flea markets and whatever, and he reissued them as official albums. He sold them again for his own pricing system. That's a pretty neat solution.
Yeah, he subsumed them or co-opted them or whatever, and
they were his, so he just, he took, there are people who would discover these properly distributed albums and buy them, not knowing that you could get them maybe cheaper if you were in the bootleg circuit. So he sort of got some of his money back, I guess. I think he used the same albums. He didn't do one thing. He didn't change the albums that the bootleggers used, the album covers. Now, you know, there's a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful piece or a booklet, I don't know, you see people with their iPads and they're inside booklet things, you know what I mean? They got leather covers. So this beautiful leather thing with two CDs and an incredible booklet that was put out by the Italian Mafia in about 1994 has pretty well most of the Bob Marshall interview in it. Laid out in a beautiful design. So I bought one and scanned through it, and they deleted the LaRouche parts. You know, the Mafia didn't want to, they put out.
They're not promoting.
Yeah, stuff about themselves that LaRouche was exposing. They weren't going to allow that to be in the booklet.
He's against the black nobility. Okay.
Yeah, so the black nobility bootlegged Zappa and took the great Bob Marshall interview and deleted all the stuff about them. it's a great object. I'm very proud to possess it. It's all about me. I caused it. So, since my background was with working with the Mafia and the Secret Council 10, it was appropriate that the Mafia probably figured out who it was. So let's get back at Bob. Let's fucking rip off this interview. We'll make a nice package. They probably knew who I was.
Probably they pulled. Yeah, they tried to throw you off the stage.
I probably bothered them back in the 50s. They had a grievance. So 40 years later, they got back at me by ripping off my interview. Stuck it right in my face. They said, Bob buys all the bootlegs. He'll see this. He'll see this.
Yeah, he'll know we excised one of his offices.
Yeah, we excised the good parts in the interview. Well, Ian's very mad that I'm reading LaRouche. He's very pissed off about it.
Watch your bones.
I'm constantly.
Yes, you're causing all types of disturbances.
Yeah.
Stop.
Yeah, did Ian say that? Did you hear Ian say that? That's what happened.
No, what
did
happened?
I say that? My reading LaRouche has caused a fucking warp in the fabric of the universe. Did he say that, Roxy? How did you know that?
Yes, he said something like that.
Okay.
In like he's blaming the Queen for everything and blah, blah, blah.
Well, he's a clone now, right? Or a double?
That's right. He's dead. I'm reading a dead guy's, his old work. these are books from the late 70s, early 80s.
Okay.
35-year-old books. Roxy has a whole bunch of them. If you go to... There's a video where Roxy goes through all the books, you know, all the stuff that I sent her. And she's got a pile, like five or six of the LaRouche books. I don't know if you show them individually in the video. You see you gathering the pile, or was that not even in the video? That was deleted. Do you remember?
No, I just say, I don't know.
That's all, yeah. You don't really get to, you see them from the distance.
Okay,
so let's go to iTunes and play Grand Wazoo or something from Grand Wazoo.
I have to say, I probably have some, a couple of synchronicities with the conversation, which is, at least with Berlin, that I'm half German, or at least on my mother's side.
Oh, okay.
She's, her name is...
Die deutsche Fraktion is here.
What did you say?
He's part of the
Deutsche Bank?
Fraktion.
What? He's part of what?
The Deutsche faction?
The German alliance.
Ah, okay, the Holy Alliance, yes. Okay, now where is the album? Trying to find which category. How does it line up? Album by artist?
You're looking at what site?
Looking at my I'm doing my iTunes.
Oh,
okay. Here it is. I think it's oddly organized.
This Rubber Dubber label, they have like hundreds of artists that they bootlegged albums from, it looks like.
Mm.
It's impressive.
Well, I'll just
so
have
that's
to...
That's a German company, or how come they're still around?
They I don't know
have
that
a lot
they're
of
still
control
around.
Here.
There's an old article, okay, from the... I think this is from let's see. The Ann Arbor Sun, 1971, Rubber Dubber Rated. A name synonymous with recorded quality and bootleg underground records was raided by federal marshals in its Los Angeles headquarters in two separate invasions, September 9th and 14th.
What year? 71?
71, yeah.
They were Frank's neighbors.
Okay, so I found the stuff.
Yeah.
We got everything unplugged. Open mic. I think it's ready. So, this is Grand Wazoo, the Grand Wazoo, and it's called Think It Over. I might play a bit and then go on to another piece, because this one's 21 minutes long. I won't play it all. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you very, very, very much. I'd like to tell you a little bit about this here band, okay? Here's the deal. This band was put together for a very short period of time. I think it was only 8 concerts, maybe 7, but I would have to count. Anyway, this is the last time this band is going to play together. This is closing night in Boston. However, it is possible. Shut up. It is possible. They'll be around. They have their career.
Bullshit.
Anyway, it's possible this band will appear maybe next year or something. But this is the end of our tour here, and we're going to make an attempt to blow it all out for you in Boston. Now, so that you won't be misled about what we're going to do up here by having us start off with something that was oriented towards a boogie, most of the rest of the stuff that we do is a little bit more abstruse. So I just wanted to break it to you easy. Some of it is harder to tap your feet to. Good. Let me get my guitar in tune. We'll progress to something a little bit weirder. Okay, the name of this piece is Approximate. Just a minute. Now, the way this piece works is the rhythm is in many instances specified for the instruments. However, the pitches that they play are left to their own discretion. So at any one time, there's a choice of about 20 different pitches being chosen all at the same time, and the piece turns out different every time you play it. This here's the Boston version.
So, Roxy, was that a mistake to let all 16 minutes play?
No.
Was that good?
No, it was amazing.
Good, good, good. And you, Bart? Were you happy with it, Bart?
I'm pleased with everything.